Hi, I'm Lisa Levin.
And I'm Julie Sapper.
We're the co-founders of Run Farther and Faster and co-hosts of the podcast under the same name.
Well, we started this podcast as a Boston Marathon-focused podcast based on the experiences from our combined 31 finishes. We cover all things running-related.
We've coached runners of all levels and goal distances all over the world for over 13 years.
Thanks so much for joining us. We are so excited you're here. Hello, everyone. It's just me today, Julie, to talk to you before we introduce our guest, who is my physical therapist, one of them, Josh Trejak. And Josh is with ProAction Physical Therapy. And the reason I wanted to talk with Josh today is because we spent a lot of time together this year while I was rehabbing my ACL. And he is just a very holistic physical therapist who has a lot of great ideas and a lot of great thoughts in terms of approaching injury as well as injury prevention. And he has a really interesting backstory. Josh was a state champion cross-country runner. He ran for Wooten High School, which is a local high school for which our favorite strength trainer, one of our favorite strength trainers, Kelly Redman, is the coach. And Kelly was Josh's coach many years ago. And it came full circle because now Josh works in the very clinic where he was treated as a high school runner, ProAction Physical Therapy. Josh received his Doctor of Physical Therapy from the University of Pittsburgh in 2020. He also has a master's degree in chronic disease, health, and physical activity from the University of Pittsburgh and has extensive teaching experience as both a primary instructor and teaching assistant while in school. He also has a lot of institutional knowledge because he is also a runner and also was a high school runner. So we get a little bit into not just about injury prevention, running and injuries among adult runners, but also treating teen runners, which is something that Lisa and I are always interested in talking about because injury prevention is tough with teens and it's very common with teens, and he treats a lot of them at his clinic. So in addition, I just wanted to let you know the reason it's just me is because Lisa is doing something very exciting over winter break. She is going to be competing with her son, Alex, at the Maccabi Pan American Games, where she is representing the U.S. as well as Alex in cycling. And Lisa will be competing in the half marathon event. And I'm really excited for Lisa because she actually did this in 2004. Before she had kids. And it's really special for her that she is going to be returning to the Pan American Games and now with her son. And it's just going to be really special for them. And when she was there in 2004, she actually was there at the same time as Dina Castor. So I was trying to think of a way to wish Lisa well as she goes on this adventure. And so I reached out through Cameo to Dina. I'll admit I got the idea from Allison Wade's newsletter, Fast Women, where she mentioned that Dina was doing cameos for the holidays. So if you're interested in doing one, I can attest that Dina does them rather quickly. You just provide the information and she does it. So I'm going to play that for you now. It was so cute and I got such a kick out of it. And of course, Lisa did too. So here's Dina.
Hi, Lisa. It's Olympic medalist in the marathon, Dina Castor, and I am joining Julie in wishing you the very best in the upcoming Maccabi Pan American Games. How exciting to close out 2023 and welcome 2024 in such style. Julie wanted you to know that as a fellow coach and podcast host, she is so very proud of everything that you're doing. This time around, making it a family affair will be extra special. Good luck in Argentina. We'll be cheering.
I mean, how awesome is that? So anyway, I'm sure that you all will join me and Dina in wishing Lisa and Alex a terrific experience at the Pan American Games. We are so proud of you both. And I wish all of you for those who celebrate, a very Merry Christmas and a happy, happy New Year. We look forward to returning after this episode in 2024. I can't believe 2024 is approaching. Here's to a wonderful year for all of you. And I will go ahead and wish myself a better year, an injury-free year, God willing. So with that, I want to introduce my physical therapist, Josh. I hope you enjoy this conversation, and I hope you all have a great week and a great rest of your holiday season. Bye. Josh Trejak, welcome to the Run Farther and Faster podcast. I'm really excited to have you on the podcast today because we've spent a lot of time together over the last year. I probably saw you truly for the first time post ACL on this date last year. It's not intentional, but when you think about it, I had my surgery December 12th and today is December 18th. I'm pretty sure I was probably weepy on your PT table right about now, exactly a year ago.
Yeah, the fun first 2 weeks of any ACL surgery type of stuff we did together. Those were some great times we had, Julie. I'll tell you that much.
It was really fun. I miss those times. But you know, Josh, I've said this a lot to our listeners, what really made my recovery so much better was being in the company of wonderful people like you and Rachel and Lauren. And even though I didn't, of course, love having to do PT, I didn't mind going because I enjoyed spending time with you all. I mean, you're all so much fun to be around. So as far as recovery from injury goes, I think I had it pretty great. So we wanted to bring you on the podcast though, because in addition to being just a really fun and kind physical therapist, you're actually an excellent physical therapist with a lot of institutional knowledge. So we thought it would be great for our listeners to learn a little bit more about you, how you approach the physical therapy, and some of the many tips that you've provided me throughout the year, I think could benefit so many of our listeners. So before we get into the nitty gritty, could you share a little bit about yourself, including your running background and a little bit about your education and how you ended up being a PT?
Yeah, great. Well, thank you again for the kind words. We definitely had a great time together in PT when we were spending the many hours rehabbing you back to where you are now. I'm a native. I grew up in Potomac, Maryland. I went to Wooten High School, where I started on the cross country team as a freshman who would rather have been anywhere else but cross country, like the football team or the soccer team or anything like that. But I had a smart dad who said, hey, you might be good at this. Why don't you give it a try? And I did. And I had a great 4 years. For any of the listeners who may recognize the name, Kelly Redmond was my high school coach at Wooten High School. And I was there for, she was there for my 4 years there. I was a middle distance runner. I was an 800 meter runner, a miler. And I was lucky enough to sort of propel myself forward into the sort of the limelight of the state meet and everything. And I was a two-time state champion in high school and was fortunate enough to then go to college for running. So I went to the University of Pittsburgh, where I majored in exercise science. I ran cross country, indoor and outdoor track the 4 years that I was there. And after which I continued at Pitt because I had loved the side of the science and performance and athletics so much that I went from exercise science to a master's degree in chronic disease, health and physical activity. During that time, I was able to teach classes, everything from weight training to anatomy lab to swim class. I mean, I got a really nice background in teaching, which I think has helped a lot in my practice, just being able to sort of verbalize things to people in ways that maybe they can understand. And then after which I pursued my doctorate in physical therapy. So I was at Pitt for a total of 7.5 years. I ended up with a bachelor's degree in exercise science, a master's degree in chronic disease, health and physical activity, and a doctorate in physical therapy. After which I moved back home. I graduated PT school in December of 2020. Heck of a year to graduate from a healthcare profession. We were kind of in the height of the COVID pandemic. Not everybody had gotten vaccines yet. So It was a trying time, to say the least. But I moved back home knowing I had a degree in physical therapy. And after a short stint at a clinic in Northern Virginia, I saw a listing on Indeed.com for Pro Action Physical Therapy. My physical therapist from high school happens to run the clinic. Some of you may know the name Rachel Miller. She was my physical therapist in high school. And that's really kind of how I got the whole love for the profession. I ran cross country in high school. I made decisions in my off season training that weren't the best, as in I did not train very hard when I should have in the off season, got myself injured during the season, went to Rachel, who Rachel combined with Kelly really kind of made me think like, hey, if you're going to do this, number one, you're going to do it the right way. And number two, like you have something here. You should really kind of move forward with this. And I really, you know, I think of both of them in my journey as pretty integral parts of it. So fast forward to May of 2021, I started May 1st, my first day at ProAction. I've been with them for 2.5 years. And ever since then, I've been fortunate enough to grow in both my love for the practice and for the profession. I got a certification in as a certified coach. So I, in addition to physical therapy, I also am a private running coach for an RRCA certification. So it's a pretty great world where I get to combine my love of physical therapy and my true like passion for the profession with a really cool aspect of my general love for running and my activity and what I do every day that, I feel like I can make a difference because I, you know, not only have I studied it and learned it in textbook, I've been out there and on the roads running, on the fields running, on the track running. So I feel very blessed and very fortunate to be in the situation that I am. I think all the experiences that I've had that I've just listed out for you has put me in the position now where I feel very, very fortunate to be, you know, working with a ton of runners, a ton of people who just, you know, need a little bit of orthopedic help. And I feel like it, myself and ProAction, we do a pretty good job of that.
Absolutely. So let's unpack that for a little bit. First of all, I love that you were coached by Kelly, who is part of our team, and that your physical therapist was Rachel, who's also part of our team. So the fact that you're a product of both of them, I think that is a huge part of why you're so good at what you do, for sure. So you were a top state runner, you were a state champion. Can you talk a little bit about when you see a high schooler come into your clinic, or even a middle schooler, a teen come into your clinic, what are some of the things that you wish you knew then that you tell them? And what are some of the common mistakes that you see when those kids come into your clinics?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I generally think that a lot of coaches in the area, and I can really only speak for Montgomery County in this aspect, because that's where I grew up, but a lot of the coaches are real top notch. I think a lot of them have a general understanding of how to best progress the masses and keep them sort of safe and prioritize certain things. And I can't really say enough about Kelly Redmond. I had coaches in high school. I had several coaches in college, and she to this day remains the best coach all around that I have ever had. And so I think that really set me up a lot. One of the things that Kelly preached a lot that I think maybe a lot of other teams don't necessarily is the injury prevention stuff. As a high schooler, you're sort of in a weird realm where you have 8 hours of just being from class to class to class, where you don't have the luxury of being able to stand up and go walking around in the back. So you take an athlete who's 16 years old, they're growing both in physically and mentally, and you stick them in a city for eight and a half hours, and then you go say, okay, go run right after that. So I think one of the things that I try to preach a lot especially to my high school runners, is it's not going to matter what you do if you aren't able to get there on race day. So it's the little things that make a big difference. When everybody is stretching at the beginning or end of practice, you take that seriously. Whenever you are on a rest day because you've ran 6 days, now it's time to rest, or whatever your rest day is, the best athletes train hard and they rest hard. And that means taking your off days and your rest days seriously. And then the little things about making sure that they have the right frame of mind, which a little bit kind of, I think, holds true with what my profession does, which is putting the person in the best position, not only to succeed in what they want to do, but keep them injury free. And one of the things I like to preach about is you really have to understand that there are time and place to run certain ways. And one of the things we see a lot are these high school kids who they get really ramped up on the mileage, and they say, okay, well, all the seniors are running 40, 50 miles a week. So I'm, 15 years old going into my sophomore year, trying to make a dent this season. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to progress my mileage. I'm going to run tempo runs in the summer. So I find a lot of what I do with my high school runners, especially, is providing education, just understanding that, your coach is telling you to do X for a reason. So whenever you do have your own ability to train, or you're going off of a general plan, like in the summer when you don't meet with your coaches, you really want to be smart with what you're doing. Because I'm trying to look out for these kids, not only for their season, about staying injury free, but also, you know, in the next several years of their lives as they progress through, taking some of these principles early on is really important. And one of the most common injuries, or at least common causes for injuries, no matter what the injury is, no matter what the age group is overtraining. And overtraining can be too much volume or too much intensity. And that is something that as a high schooler with your body adapting and everything, and you're still learning, sometimes that stuff can be, you know, really apparent, where I did a hard workout the next day, my right leg is sore as heck and my left leg feels great. Or it's, I'm gone 2 weeks and I don't even realize that this thing on the back of my heel is beginning to get sore and sensitive to the touch. And that's when, you know, that whole youthfulness tends to creep up on you, where, okay, now it's been 3 weeks since that injury might've first started, but this is the first time I'm having to deal with it. So I try to provide education more than anything else. And not so much from a performance standpoint, from just a overall standpoint, but it does tend to lead itself into performance. I just want kids to not be in my clinic. You know, that's what it comes down to. And so I think that's probably the most amount of what I do, just the preaching, the education thing. And I, you know, with any kid, you try not to overstep on the coach. If the coach says run this, that, and the other, you as a PT, it's not your job to say you should not be doing that. This is not you, unless you feel that this is a significant reason that they are going to get injured, in which case you counsel or provide education. I try not to take over the training too much. I think that's an important part of our job.
What about with teen girls? Because clearly, I think we talk about this a lot, how the evolution of a teen girl through high school, a lot of them change a lot, as do boys. But as boys grow, they develop more testosterone, they have more power, and it's more of an advantage. Whereas often teenage girls experience a dip during their high school performance, which can lead to injury, of course, because they believe that if their body's changing, perhaps they're doing something wrong. And we've talked about this ourselves, and it can lead to red S, and that can lead to injuries. How do you approach that when you have, when you're treating teen girls, teen athletes? Is there anything in particular that you look for as a PT, anything that is a red flag for you that you would pass along to parents as they navigate sort of that complicated time while kids are still growing?
With the female high school athlete, it's obviously a very, it can be a very delicate situation, especially as a healthcare practitioner, because it is our obligation to report or refer things that we find could be possibly, you know, borderline hurtful to themselves. And so another perfect example, and you don't necessarily need to be like the physical signs of hurting themselves. It could be what they don't realize they're doing. And overtraining is a perfect example of that, especially when it comes to females who are going in through the process of maturing. You have bone density to deal with, you have the menstrual cycle to deal with, you have things that are outside of the realm of what typical, you know, a male in that age group might present with. And that's not insignificant. And as a PT, especially as a male PT, that can be a little dicey sometimes too. The first thing you have to do as any healthcare practitioner is establish a huge level of trust. That trust can be like, in a conversation, that trust can be, here are my credentials, this is why you should trust me. But it's a relationship. It's one of the unique things about PT. You see a doc, an orthopedic, you might get a 15-minute sesh with them, you might get less, you might get more, but you're with me for 45, you're with me, just me. And it's not one visit, it's usually more than that. So you build a foundation and a trust. I'm probably not going to say you're doing this, and this wrong on the very first session. It's going to take a little bit of time for us to realize exactly what's going on and is this what's causing it. But one of the things you think about is that you have this female athlete, they had a really successful freshman year, and it's time to up the ante. And what you commonly see in high school female runners is that they might have a really good freshman year, a really good sophomore year, but you do see a dip at times. And not all runners progress like that. I mean, the men don't either, but I feel like, and this is not based on anything scientific at all, you do see a little bit of a dip in some of the high school female performance, especially when they come out the gate so hot. So providing the insight of, trust me, I know that you believe that running X will get you to Y, but let's take a step back and figure, if we continue on this path, will we lead to further injuries? So you think about some of the injuries you see in high school runners, especially the females, right? You got bone injuries, that's definitely common, stress fractures, stress reactions, things like that. The novice runner injury, or sort of like that, when I first pick up running, my shins get a little bit sore. That tends to happen, but I find that, you know, when it comes to some more of the difficult conversations, you're dealing more with the psyche, right? The, are you doing the right thing for you? And do you think you're doing the right thing for you? We've all had coaches who maybe push us a little too hard. And that does sometimes get a little dicey with the saying of, hey, you, I know you are being told X, but right now I think it's best for you to do Y. But then the other thing too, is the danger of comparison. Not everybody is built the same. And you see these runners, not just female, who they say, all my friends are running this, so I should be able to run this. I was a runner in high school with a training partner that could run probably twice the mileage that I could, because I was not that kind of runner. I was not built for that kind of mileage. My body was geared towards more fast twitch fibers. And so inevitably, we both want to get to the finish line first, but we have different ways of going about that. So if you have an athlete in front of you, and you know in your heart of hearts that they're going about this in a way that could potentially get them injured, that's where you intervene. You don't intervene as a physical therapist if you think the way they're going about it is wrong from a performance standpoint. But if they're going to hurt themselves, if they're overtraining, or if they're doing things that you think, you know, in a couple of years, this could come back to bite you, you got to intervene. And the warning signs we all kind of see are the sort of, you know, the general fatigue, the bone density scans, the iron levels, the mental health side of things, which is a huge component of this, especially in 2023 with social media, with Strava, with the running websites that you can mile split, the ones you compare each other with. It's dangerous. You have to sort of walk a line. And as a practitioner, it's difficult. But being out for 2.5 years, the more you have the conversation, the easier it gets. You got to get with somebody who you trust, somebody who you can build that relationship with. And that as a PT can be hard sometimes. It can be hard from a clinic, depending on where you work and your setting, but it can be hard to have that comfort level. And that's where running and overtraining yourself as a speaking for myself specifically, I feel like I have that rapport and that conversation. But the most important thing, and I'll finish it with this one, is you can't be afraid to have the conversation. Because if you see it, you have to say something. You have to approach it right, but you can't dance around the issue. You say, I think what you're doing here may be leading to what the problem is, why you're with me in the first place. And as a result, I think we need to take a step back. And I think you really need to listen to me, because I think this is something that you and I can work through together. I think we can get you to this point, but we may have to approach it in a slightly different way. It's a hard conversation, but it's got to be had.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that you're having a conversation. And I think also what helps is, because you've now been practicing for a little while, you're able to cite examples to these kids and say, I understand that this right now, it may look like you're not going to get faster because you've had a dip in performance. But trust me, I've treated other patients and this is what I've seen. And if they can recognize those patterns and trust your experience as well as the evidence, then they might be more likely to lean into the treatment and recognize that you're not at all derailing their progress. You're avoiding injury so they can continue progressing well past high school, which is the goal, especially for the kids that want to run in college.
Yeah, and it goes beyond high school runners as well. You just have to establish rapport and a good relationship. And you could be the best PT in the world, but if you rub somebody the wrong way, the trust factor goes out the window. And that is everything. Perceived level of care is so important. Whether you're getting the best care or not, if you perceive that you are getting high quality of care, you will always do better for the most part compared to if you are getting the same care, but you perceive it being slightly different, slightly worse, worse report, worse, just worse. Your psyche is key in this respect.
I totally agree. And I think that's important in terms of when you're deciding on which PT you're going to use when selecting a PT for treatment. I think even if that PT has the best reviews ever, if you don't feel comfortable with him or her, it's not going to work. So yeah, I completely agree with you. Rapport is so important, along with, of course, expertise. So speaking of patterns, now that you've seen hundreds of patients, what do you think are some of the most common patterns that lead to runner injuries? And of course, what are those injuries?
Yeah, I mean, you know, your typical runner's injuries yield anything from shin splints, like we said, to plantar fasciitis, Achilles tendonitis, hamstring strains, gluteal strains, the tendonitis is the sort of the thing you think about when it comes to overuse. The muscle strains come in when there's a little bit of a muscle imbalance occurring, or some muscles are doing too much, some muscles aren't doing enough. I think there's a lot of it's hard to say what is the thing that is the most common thing, but one of the things I guess a few of the things that I see are, number one, overtraining. So overtraining or undertraining is kind of your, like, you know, you got to find the sweet spot. It's not a small sweet spot. There's a big range there of undertraining and overtraining. The undertraining thing is I run twice a week. I do 2 miles a run, and then I go on the weekends and I run a 15-mile long run because there's something there. We'll revisit that. Then there's the overtraining. I run 6 days a week, and on my seventh day, I go for a 2-mile walk or a 2-hour walk rather. And you're thinking, okay, well, where's the rest day in there? I would say. And then I guess the two other things are, number one, you're not using the right muscles. Okay, we're using the right muscles, and that's a whole other, you know, point that we're going to get into. But the one of the things I think doesn't get talked about enough is, if you ran as a teenager, or if you ran in your 20s, let's say you started running after college or something like that, your body is fundamentally different at 25 than it is at 45. There's many reasons for that. Number one, you've matured, you've grown, your body has changed physically. Sure, your lifestyle's changed too. When you're 25, you have X amount of sleep, you have this certain sleep patterns, you have certain activities, you may go out a little bit later. When you're 45, you might be more geared towards a family life. You might have a more sort of set in job where things are set, and you're maybe for the most part sedentary, as compared to 25, you weren't as sedentary. So your body's changing. You train the same way at 25, you do at 45. There's something there that's not exactly the same, and that could be nothing at all. Or that could lead you to injury because you're treating your body the same as you did 20 years ago. And fundamentally, 20 years is a lot of time. So I think that's something that doesn't get talked about enough. But I do think that the majority of runners that we see in the clinic, which are runners coming from what I would guess is a pretty good background or understanding of what to do running and all that, I would say it's usually the wrong type of muscles that are working for certain tasks. So compensation is a big element of running that occurs as muscles don't understand or know what they're supposed to do, and therefore other muscles kick in. And we see a lot of common patterns with that. Or it's the, I have gone my whole life without stretching. Why do I need to stretch now? Well, if I'm not taking proper care of my muscles, then it's going to get me into trouble. One of the things I tell a lot of the runners that I coach is that you're not going to get any faster on the day you run. It's the recovery where protein synthesis occurs. You're breaking down muscle tissue. You're building it back up on your rest days. You don't leave enough time for rest and recovery. You're going to impair your rest. You're going to impair your recovery. And you're going to impair your performance as a result. So I think the main thing I see in my world is that people are not allowing their body to recover. And as a result, it leads to more fatigue, less recovery, which leads to then muscling through some of your runs, compensation, and leading to then eventual injury. Because chances are you're not seeing me unless you did something along the way to get yourself injured. And I'd say that's probably the most common reason. I use the wrong things to do the right things.
So building off of that, what are some of the things, in addition to, of course, making sure that you fuel on your recovery and rest days, making sure you take in sufficient macro and micronutrients and all of those things, and having sufficient rest, what are some things that you think generally across the board runners need to be better at doing to prevent coming into your clinic regularly?
Yeah, the nutrition's huge, right? So just as you mentioned, nutrition's huge, especially as you get older, you can rely less on kind of getting away with it. So that's definitely a big part. Sleep is huge. That's where your recovery happens. So if you do not prioritize good sleep, then that is certainly going to get you in trouble. And, you know, if you have trouble sleeping, or if there's areas in which, you know, I can't sleep Monday or Sunday nights, I never sleep. Well, then that's something that you maybe want to address, especially as you get into later stages of a training phase, because that's where your recovery is the most important. But not to answer your question, I think the main thing is that people tend to not take parts of the training process seriously that is outside of running. So they're really good about the running part, okay? But training is so much more than that. You, as I mentioned earlier, compensation is like the thing that generally leads to injury. And as people, we're compensators by nature. And that's a lot of that has enabled us to evolve to what we are now. But if you don't stretch, if you don't do strength training, if you don't do the little ancillary things, the sort of the seasonings on the dish, then what's going to happen is your recovery is going to be impaired. There's no question about it. So recovery is not always rest and relax. Recovery can often be, did I set myself up for success? And then sometimes this goes back between, you know, the beginnings of your training phases all the way before your season started, or it could take place mid-season. So perfect example is if you've run and your quads always feel like they are really tired after a run, chances are you're using them a whole lot and there are other muscles you're not using a lot. Because if you can identify one muscle group is always tired, sore, and a little bit just more than all the others, you're probably using that more. Now, do you use your quads a lot when you're run? Sure. But you also use your glutes, you use your calves. And why aren't these guys sore? I mean, you might think, well, okay, well, the quads are the strongest muscle in my body. I'm using them. I want to use them. Well, what we see in the clinic, and there have been books written about this, is I am great at using my quads, but when it comes time to using my glutes, I have a little trouble with that. And that's something that we see all the time. You go across the board. I don't care if you're a runner, soccer player, if you are a person that likes to do workouts in the gym, if you're a person that likes to do workouts at home, it's difficult to use your glutes. There are reasons for that. Tightness in the hip flexors and quads can sometimes inhibit the glute muscles from firing. Weakness in the core, weakness and lack of activation in the lower abdominal muscles can impair the ability for the glutes to fire at optimal efficiency. So there are factors that are sometimes beyond the level of, I just need to get on the ground, do some glute bridges. There are factors that sometimes can go well beyond this. I had a woman today, she had a C-section a few years ago, and this is something that affects a lot of people. Pregnancy affects the body in ways that are just numerous in the ways. The ability to fire and recruit your lower abdominal muscles. I would tell any woman who gives birth to go and see a women's health specialist either during or after the process, because there is inevitability that there is some kind of deficit after the fact, and it may unearth itself immediately or it may unearth itself later down the road. But the things that you see are when we don't allow recovery to occur, and recovery is not all sleep, rest, relax, stretch, all that, when our muscles are not recovered, sometimes it's we have to roll and stretch them out. And I'm a big proponent of rolling and stretching, sure. But we have to sometimes even take a further step back and say, why are these things happening? And the root cause in a lot of aspects is just my muscles are doing too much over here and not enough here. And that's where a lot of what we do as physical therapists come in. And that's where I feel like my most success is just helping runners to get the right things to do the right things.
Yeah, I mean, we see that a lot together. We both work at the Run Performance Lab, and we watch people run on a treadmill, and then we do just, we video, but we also, with our eyes, can see right away if someone's not using their glutes when they run. And I've been thinking about this. I think part of it, we see that all the time. Think about it. A lot of the people who come to the clinic, especially in the evening, they've been sitting in their offices all day, or at home or at work, and then they drive in their car to the clinic, and then we have them get on the treadmill, and we don't give anyone a lot of time to do some glute activation. So I sometimes wonder if we were to watch them run in a different setting when they had time to do some dynamic stretching and they were up and about a little bit before they started to run, would their glutes fire a little better? I don't know the answer, but my point is, do you think that there's a correlation between the amount of sitting that people do and their underuse of their glutes?
If you sit on the muscle all day, chances are it's not going to work very well. You can apply constant pressure to a muscle and elicit a response that may be beneficial or detrimental. You can apply stress to a muscle and prolonged pressure to it, and at times you can create a neural inhibitory effect. So yeah, I mean, I buy that, but I even would go a step further. What happens to your body for the period of time that you are sitting, I think is overall has more bearing on it than simply I sit on the butt tissue. The ischial tuberosities come through and got contact of the glute muscles, and therefore they don't fire. I think the sitting constantly, how many people, tight hip flexors, right? Oh, my psoas muscle, my tight hip flexors, such a common thing. Why? Well, we sit in a 90 degree angle at our hips all day. Now it comes time to straighten out the length in those muscles, and your body's not going to want that. It's going to take your pelvis with you, and you're going to create something called an anterior pelvic tilt. And the glute muscles, when they fire, the gluteus maximus muscles fire to create a posterior pelvic tilt. So if our tightness is literally causing the opposite of what the glute muscles want to do, it's just going to be asking our muscles to fire at a rate that's more than what they would normally at rest. If we ask the muscles to fire from a neutral position, then they're going to be more advantageous than a detrimental position. So yeah, I totally buy it. I think the run to form slab point's a great point. I mean, how many times do you run and it doesn't take you more than, or it doesn't take you less than 2 miles to get warmed up? We're telling, all right, go run for 1 minute. We're going to look at what you run look like. I think it lends itself to a good perspective though. What are you going to look like 5 miles in, 10 miles into a run? You're a runner. You want to run a half marathon. What do you look like 9 miles in? Well, running your first minute is not necessarily indicative of what you're going to look like, but maybe we're going to see some of the deficits you present with that may creep up miles 8, 9, and 10. So I think in a perfect world, you're right. We have those people go for a little bit longer. And it does feel repetitive at times, right? Weak glutes. Yeah. Weak glutes. All right. Next one. Yeah. Probably weak glutes. Why? If it wasn't such a common thing, there wouldn't be books and studies and literature on it, because it's true. We're great at using our quads, not so much with the glutes.
So what do you tell someone who is listening and is like, well, I understand, but I work at a desk all day and that is my life and I run. What advice do you have for those folks who want to improve glute activation, but their lifestyle is what most people's lifestyle is? You have to sit and work a lot during the day. What are your tips?
Yeah, that's a good question, because inevitably the worst advice you can give somebody is, oh, you sit 8 hours a day. Why don't you just stand for your entire workday instead? Because I don't see any reason why that would be a problem going from one extreme to the other, right? No, that would be a little bit too much. So what I tell patients is this: look at the clock, top and bottom of every hour, stand for a minute, squeeze your butt. You want to make the most important like component of behavior change in people is the ease for which you can make their life easy, basically by changing the behavior. So if you tell somebody, I need you to stand for 30 minutes every hour, some people, they're going to rock and roll with that. They're going to say, you know what? You're right. I know I need to do that. I have a standing desk. I don't use it. I'm going to do that. But that's not the reality of the greater United States or in this county, you know, it's one thing, but how do you tell somebody whose desk setup because of COVID is a shoebox on top of their dining room that, hey, you need to stand up more? Well, it's hard. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. It's hard. And you have to meet the person where they're at. So what I tell patients is, at the top and bottom of every hour, stand for a minute, give your hip flexors a break from being in that 90 degree angle, let them lengthen out a little bit. And in that position, why don't you practice glute squeezing? Because if you manage to be adherent to that, chances are you're standing between 12 and 16 times a day. And that is a minute, 12 to 16 times a day, where they're actively trying to recruit their glutes. So that's something I tell people to like, wake up the hip flexors, wake up the glutes a little bit. But in terms of how to fire the glute, it's difficult to be able to fire the glute independent of the hamstring or the quad muscles. The reason for that is the hamstring and the glute do a very similar action. They both extend the hip or move the leg backwards. It's just they do it with the knee positioned in different ways. The hamstring, like the quad, is not going to have a problem firing. So it's going to want to take over for the glute in almost any aspect it can. So if you're doing a glute bridge where you're lying on your back and your knees are bent to about a 45 to 50 degree angle, you may feel some hamstring activity. What activation insufficiency shows us is if you bend the knee slightly more, then you can have less hamstring firing. So that's a tip for just general, like how to make my glutes fire. Why don't you try bending your knees a little bit? What if you're standing? You can't do that. Your legs are straight. You're standing at a desk. So I tell patients, slowly contract your glutes. Put your hands on them. Make sure that you can feel those cheeks literally squeezing together. And there are people, many people, some of your listeners will stand up. They will put their hands on their glutes and they will say, can I feel that? Is that working? Can you squeeze one glute independent of the other? Can I squeeze my left glute consciously, actively? Listeners, I want you to try doing this right now. Squeeze your left glute, relax. Now squeeze your right glute and relax. If you're having trouble doing that, there's a firing component that needs to be addressed, because if not, and you put miles and miles and miles and miles on your legs, chances are there's going to be an imbalance that comes in. Now, you don't need to be able to squeeze one cheek from another to be able to run 50 miles or run a 3-hour marathon, but it lends itself to the idea that your muscles are actually doing what they're supposed to do, and they know what to do. And that's another thing too. The muscles that know what to do are muscles that work better. And if you can't squeeze your glute independent of your hamstring, that's going to lead to compensation. Compensation leads to injury. So what I tell patients is you got to keep it simple. Stand up from your work. Squeeze your butt every 30 seconds. Sit back down. Don't make it too complicated. I love standing desks. If you're sitting all day and you get yourself a standing desk, don't stand for 8 hours. Integrate it. Build it in slow. You're not going to say, I'm signing up for a marathon in 3 months. I'm going to run 26 miles today. So, you know, it's easing back into things, not thinking that what you're doing is horrible or anything. No, you're a product of the system. The 21st century lifestyle is that we sit at desks, we work. A few hundred years ago, we weren't doing that. We were standing, we were moving, we were doing manual labor jobs. In the grand course of evolution, sitting and working at desks has become a really quick and common trend relative to like the just general evolution of our species. So our bodies just haven't adapted to that quickly. And so trying to break out of that's challenging. Small things, little things add up over a big time. That's what I tell patients, little things.
So speaking of little things, if you had all your wishes come true and every patient came to you with a base of strength training, what are the exercises that you would hope every patient does, even when they're done with physical therapy, every patient meaning runners, what are just like the key exercises that you would like to see people doing all the time, not just when they're being treated by you?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're going to get a ton of different answers from any PT you ask, because we all have our certain set of like, I really like this exercise because it builds on this component or builds on this perspective. But here's the main thing. Number one, if you're a runner, you're healthy, and you're trying to build strength, doing it in a position or in a manner that is running specific is key. And what do I mean by that? Double leg squats are awesome if you are doing them safely, correctly, appropriately, and you're dosing them appropriately. A single leg squat is objectively more running specific than a double leg squat. I don't say go, everybody, runners, do single leg squats, but you sure as heck better be doing something on one leg. Running is a single leg sport, left leg, right leg. There's a period of time where you're not on the ground, but there's never a period where you're on 2 feet to characterize running and the textbook diagnosis. So what you're going to do is you're going to stand on one leg, you're going to soften your knee, you're going to push your big toe into the ground, and you're going to squeeze your butt. What you're doing there is you're starting to activate down the chain all the things that need to be firing and active when running. So let's break that down. You're on one leg, right? You're pushing your big toe down lightly to provide sensation into your brain, understanding that my foot is on the ground, but also to activate the longitudinal arch in your foot to be able to actually hold your arch up. What does that do? Prevents against overpronation, but also provides a stable base for the first point of contact that hits the ground. So that's number one. Got to be pushing that big toe down. Soft knee. If I lock my knee, I'm promoting a ton of quad activity, which can, as we mentioned, could potentially inhibit some glute activity. Not all the time, not every case, but if your knee is soft, your quad's not firing like crazy. So I don't need you bent and losing height, but I need that knee to be able to wiggle so it's soft, okay? So we have big toe push down, we have a soft knee, we have our glutes engaged. If we're on one leg and we're squeezing our glute, the leg you're standing on, there should be some work on the outside of that hip. It shouldn't be super fatiguing or shouldn't really feel like you're eliciting a huge resisted response. But what that's gonna do is it's gonna activate your gluteus medius, which is one of the most underutilized muscles in the body. If you tell me, Josh, you can predict one muscle group is weak in this person, it's almost always gonna be the gluteus medius.
And that's the area on the outside of your glute muscle.
If you take your hand and you make it a C, and you put it right on the side of you to cup your pelvis, chances are your thumb is either on or right near that gluteus medius muscle. And when you stand on that one leg, you should feel it pop into your finger. If you find your hip bone on the side, come a little bit up, come a little bit back, and you should be on it. But yeah, I mean, it's key. So you're standing on one leg with me if you're a runner. That's number one, absolutely. And then it's really about finding what works and what doesn't. I love glute bridges. I try to give them to everybody because I really think they're good for teaching core stability, glute activation, and pelvic control. However, if you do a bunch of glute bridges and you feel them in your hamstrings, and I want you to be honest with yourselves, do I feel glute bridges in my hamstring muscles? If you do, chances are your glutes aren't firing. So for some people, we can just give them a simple cue. Hey, try and squeeze your butt cheeks together a little bit more on the way up and especially on the way down. If that doesn't work, we try to get them into maybe a different cue, a different position. But if that's not firing, then there's not working. If there's not connecting, you got to take it a step back and start with simple glute squeezes. Lie on your stomach, bend your knees, put your heels together, and squeeze your butt. Try getting the ability to squeeze your butt back, because again, you would be surprised how many people struggle with that. So between, you know, the single leg exercises and typical glute bridges, anything else that is sort of matched to the individual is really the key, because the key, the golden rule in physical therapy is it depends. So if I have this person who can stand on one leg and looks physically solid, we're doing dynamics, we're doing single leg squats, we're doing Y balance, we're doing like resisted tap standing. But if you get somebody who's moving around too much, the pelvis isn't stable, the core is not firing, you got to get them on the table, you got to get working there, and you got to build up smartly, which is why, you know, working with a coach can be huge, because they can oftentimes recognize those things. Working with a trainer, going to a PT with some history of running injuries or injuries in general, saying, hey, I got to start a training phase and I'm worried my body's going to break down. That's when that comes key. I can't give you a solid, I do this, this, and this, but you got to match the intervention to the individual. Stand on one leg, it helps.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the work that I did with you is those little things where I was standing on one leg and trying different glute activation exercises while doing isolation and balance, because I came to you already with a good strength base, but the little things that I needed tweaking to fix my ACL were things that I wouldn't have been able to do on my own, because you were able to pinpoint just, oh, I see here your knee is wobbling a little bit when you're trying to squat in this weird position that I have you in, contorted while throwing a ball. So, you know, I appreciated that you paid attention to that detail. And you were able to do that. And that's what where the expertise of a physical therapist comes in. And that is why Lisa and I, whenever there's something going on with one of our runners, when they feel consistent pain beyond a day or two, where just not running for a few days to give the body a break doesn't heal it, first line of intervention for us is PT, because that's what you are able to do, is to look at those little things, figure out what's not firing, and ideally solve it before it becomes an injury. So if there's anything that any of our listeners take out of this conversation today, it's you don't have to be injured to go to a PT. You can feel that something's not right. You can even say before you start a running program, you know what, I want a PT to just check me out and make sure that my body is responding well to my running before I ramp up to run a marathon. And that is something that a running coach cannot do. It's the expertise of a physical therapist who is able to do that. And that's why it's so important.
And Julie, I've had runners come to me. We've done an initial eval. I've told them what their imbalances are. I told them what they need to work on. And I say, you do not need repetitive visits for physical therapy. You need a plan. This is what it is. Go do. It's not necessarily you have to be already injured, but it's also up to the healthcare provider to say you need X amount of visits. I need to justify it to your insurance company, X, Y, and Z. Sometimes it's as simple eval to be like, actually, I think you might be good. But to go back real quick, one point to what you said earlier, and I think it's spot on, Julie. If you can run 4 miles, but you get to mile five and that's where your pain starts, or you can run 10 miles a week, but then when you get to 14, 15, that's where injuries start to happen. It's not the big things that are getting you in trouble. The big things that get people in trouble are, I can't go up a curb, or when I sit down, it hurts. If you can run 10 miles, if you can run 2 to 3, if it hurts only at certain points, you're not here for the big stuff. The big stuff can sometimes be easy. Sometimes it's hard, but sometimes it can be easy. It's the little things that get you in trouble. And that is a huge component of what we do, is trying to educate on, you aren't weak, you aren't doing everything wrong, but we need to cue this, we need to tweak this, because it's the little things that get you in trouble.
Absolutely. And I think that is the case. Achilles injuries and Achilles tendinosis and tendonitis are super common among runners, yeah, along with plantar fasciitis. And often it is something that has nothing to do with the foot, yeah, that causes it. It's something really little going on. And that's something that I feel like a PT is so able to identify, sometimes better than a podiatrist, not always, but if it's not yet at the level of a pronounced injury, but it's just something that's bothering you after mile 9, that's when you go to a PT before.
Yeah, the amount of Achilles and plantar fasciitis patients I've had who have maybe some trigger points in their calf or some tightness, but for the most part, their glutes just not firing. I mean, I can't even count the amount. It's probably more than 50%. It's like, yeah, I know your foot hurts and we're treating the foot, But there is an imbalance up the chain where you could be solid from the heel to the knee to the hip. But if you are not solid in your center of mass, what are we talking about? There's injuries that could be everywhere when you have instability in the hips. So yeah, I'm with you. There's so many things that go beyond just the foot and ankle complex when it comes to Achilles and foot. So I'm with you there. And we're on the treatment side, right? We've seen what happens in the before, middle, and after. Sometimes the ID stuff is paramount. So important. I will refer out to a good podiatrist all the time. But when it comes to the intervention, nobody would argue that's what we do. So seeing us at the beginning, middle, and end, and that's kind of where the world of physical therapy has grown to, right? Direct access physical therapy. Come see me. Burden the healthcare system less. I've seen it. I can identify this, but I also know where this starts and where it ends. And I've done this enough to be able to kind of get you there. That's the confidence you should be instilling in your patient when you see them.
Absolutely. So touching on something quite the opposite. Let's talk for a minute about my ACL, because what happened to me that was not something where it came out of nowhere. And I really spent a lot of time thinking about what could have caused this. And I still don't know the answer. And so as a patient of yours, I really struggled this year, not only with having to rehab, really, in terms of injuries, one of the worst injuries out there. I mean, there's a reason it's discussed at any NFL game. They talk about a player who gets injured, they'll say ACL, and they'll talk about how quick their rehab is because they came back within a year. It's just, so I spent a lot of time thinking, what could have caused this? I did all the right things. I am someone who's strength trained. I am someone who warmed up before my runs. I'm a freaking running coach. And this happened to me. So I'm a patient. I'm sure you have many of us where you couldn't necessarily pinpoint what caused my injury. You only could treat it. But I have to ask you, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, what do you think caused my injury?
I know you've talked about the ACL in depth with this because I've listened and I know it's been such a huge part of your life over the last year. And I've been fortunate and unfortunate enough to go through this journey with you. You know, just like a standpoint back up, the ACL, the anterior cruciate ligament, it connects your femur to your tibia, which are your two leg bones. So your femur is your big leg bone above the knee and your tibia is the low big leg bone below the knee. Just connects the two. So when your tibia and your foot plants and you turn and you move, your tibia tends to get fixed there. And your femur, if it moves a little too much, boom, that's where the ACL tears. You talk about NFL games, talk about how turf, you know, your foot sticks in there a little bit more. And that's why the ACL tear is a little bit more prevalent, because your tibia is going to be fixed and your femur is going to move because you plant and then you go. Now, why did your ACL tear? That's a tricky one. For the runners listening to this podcast, distance runners and ACL tears, it's not a common thing. Distance runners do not do the thing that generally stresses the ACL. So that's number one. We already have to be like, okay, so Julie's not doing a lot of cutting, planting, pivoting sports that would tear the ACL. So number two, we have to take a step back and look at the profile, right? So Julie, you are, you're a mom, meaning you have been, you know, at some degree through the process of, you know, you had pregnancy, which pregnancy tends to lead to ligamentous laxity. Sometimes it sort of generally gets a little better and sometimes it does not and it stays lax. And that's a big component of this. If the ligament moves too much, that means there's going to be a lot of play in those joints where the femur can move quite a bit and it gets used to that and it moves a little bit more and it moves a little bit more. And, you know, you are not in high school, which is the typical presentation of an ACL tear we see nowadays, high school athletes. But every year you get older, the body and the ligaments in general are less able to sustain the forces we put on them. And so one of the things that I think you did that may or may not have caused this is you perform an activity or a sport that is highly repetitive. Your muscles, based on the principle of specificity, which states that your muscles will adapt to the stimulus for what you provide them. If you do a lot of running, your muscles are going to get used to that. You play a lot of basketball, your muscles get used to that. You take a distance runner who's been running for 40 years, never done anything else, put them on a basketball court, it's going to be a little bit of a muscle. I got to figure this out. So you do a sport, you run straight, you turn this, that, and the other, you might run some trails, but it has nothing to do with the idea of you providing assistance in a sport where you probably have no business of providing assistance with. And for the listeners who probably know your history of how this happened, you know, with the cheerleading and everything, this is just something your body was not prepared for, number one. Number two, you probably were providing or performing an activity where force production was so high that you were likely, again, compensating and maybe muscling through the activity a little too much. I think in purest, simplest forms, your body was not prepped for the high explosive, high intensity, short duration type of activity you performed. And as a result, the thing that was the straw that broke the camel's back, broke the camel's back. Were you going to tear your ACL if you didn't do this activity? I don't know. No one's going to be able to theorize that. But I've had ACL patients from trampoline parks to playing soccer with their kids to taking a step off a curb. I don't think you would have stepped off a curb and torn your ACL, but there's definitely a factor of components that lead up to why. And as a PT, the nice thing is we don't really have to deal with the why. That can be the hardest part sometimes. Patient comes into a doc. Hey, why did this happen? Doc has to go, okay, well, I've only known you for 2 minutes. Let me figure out your life story here. But I think it was body wasn't ready for the thing you asked it to do. You were doing it. You were thinking about somebody else. You were thinking about something else. And your knee took the stress that it was not and is not prepared for based on your history as a distance runner.
I think that's a great answer. It was an anomalous activity. I was spotting my daughter in a back handspring in our basement, and it just, I normally don't need to spot her, but I was trying to keep her safe. And ironically, in doing so, my foot planted, et cetera. But I appreciate that. And I think that's a great explanation. I think also, I'll say it, the fact that I'm 51 and I'm in the stage of menopause, I do think that there is a connection, just like there is with childbirth. It does change your ligaments and tendons. And to that end, do you have any observations in terms of the masters runners you treat in injury? What do you see in terms of masters runners, in terms of how they respond to your treatment? And do you think that there's anything you wish masters runners would or would not do based on your years of experience so far?
So let's start off with the disclaimer that you, as a master's runner, the folks that are listening, the ACL is generally not something you're going to stress a lot. So that's number one. Unless you plan on spotting some back handsprings anytime soon. The thing that I see with master's runners, let's start with the positives first. If I say, hey, I think a few days off is going to help you, in my experience, they are more likely to be amenable to that than my high school or my college or my runners who are maybe in denial about just where they are in life at this point. So I think that generally master's runners have a little bit more experience under their belt. And as a result, I think they're more likely to listen to somebody who is a quote unquote professional in this regard. My master's runners that I treat, number one, stride length, it's too short. It's not necessarily too short. It's that there's a lack of an explosive component to it. Running is by nature not an explosive sport, but you sure as heck need to be able to propel yourself. And as you get older, force production decreases, testosterone production decreases, the type 2 fibers in your muscles, which are the muscles responsible for the fast twitch stuff, those decrease as well. So these are all components of why the runner, as they age, tends to gear more towards a shuffling gait. Now, I don't need you to try to leap, okay? I don't want you to try to change the form so much that you're then doing something you're not supposed to, but the shuffling of running tends to lead to more problems and can lead to more injuries. So if you think about it, what's happening? You're reducing impact, but you may be increasing the amount of work that muscles need to work on. If you're shuffling, chances are you might be kind of clawing at the ground, maybe activating those hamstrings more than they ought to be in that case. Runners who are shuffling, they tend to be maybe a little bit more kind of at risk of the trips and falls because they're not picking up their feet. I find, and this is crazy to me, it really is, I find that the master's runners tend to have more falls. You would think, well, yeah, that's logical. I mean, they're getting older, they tend to trip more, but it's like, well, if you're older, you should know that you're more at risk for this. But no, that's what we see. I see a lot of runners, especially as they get into the masters, they have trips, they have falls. There's an element of, I've been doing this my whole life, or I've been doing this for so long, why do I need to do anything different now? And I think that's, you know, as much as I'd like to think that master's runners tend to get that a little bit easier, there are, of course, the some that don't. And there's a huge component to why that might be. And that is, for some of these folks, they identify first as a runner. I mean, up until I became a physical therapist, you asked me, Josh, what do you identify as? I'm a runner. I'm sure I'm a male. I'm I'm 28, or I, you know, I'm a graduate of a college or a program, but no, I'm a runner. People from high school, oh, Josh, yeah, he's the runner, yeah. So if your identity is rooted in running and someone is telling you, number one, you're running, it needs to change. Number two, you need to do less of it. Number two or three, you need to take a break from it. That's a tough conversation to have. So I think for the masters runners, you know, getting into the mindset of there is, oh, my body is different and therefore I may have to adjust the way I train. I may have to do things differently. And everybody, like I said, it depends. Every runner is different. You and I have worked with a runner, Julie, who's in his mid 70s. He's run all sorts of marathons. And he came to me with a problem last year that he was running to the left or to the right. He wasn't running straight, wasn't in pain. He was feeling, but he couldn't run straight. That is not a problem that a 19-year-old has. Okay, we have to take a step back and think. And yes, rest was an important component of getting him better, but it was understanding that, hey man, even though you've been doing this for 50 years, it's time to add a day of strength and a less day of running so that we can get you back to where you want to be. It's the, I have to recognize my body is different and therefore I have to do something different. Einstein's definition of insanity, right? Doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result. That's what this comes down to, is that as you get older, you cannot expect the same result without doing something a little differently. I think my master's runners for the most part get that, but as distance runners tend to show, they're a little bit on the stubborn side. And that's where the conversation may have to become a little bit more of a friendship or rapport, so that they trust that you are not trying to say, no more running. I have plenty of people I know come to me. If PT told me no running, doctor told me no running. That's not the remedy. The remedy is, if you want to do this, we got to figure out how we can get you to that. And chances are there's something we're going to need to tweak. And that can be a difficult conversation at times.
I appreciate you bringing up the shuffling, because I do think that's something that is absolutely across the board that a lot of distance runners do. And that's because long, slow distance pace, easy pace, LSD pace is so critical to developing an aerobic engine. And often when folks are running easy pace, it inevitably turns into a little bit of a shuffle. So what advice do you have to fix that? Something that comes to mind to me is doing activities like jump rope that force you to work a little bit on power at the same time that you're working on turnover. Is there anything else that you would recommend to fix a shuffle so that one can still run efficiently, but not so close to the ground and risk tripping?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm thinking of specifically, let's just use an example. We have a patient who's in their late 60s, who's been running for 30 years, whose gait pattern is such where now maybe there are a few pounds more than they used to be. Maybe their stride is a little bit shorter than they used to be, and they're shuffling a little bit now. So the golden answer of physical therapy, right? It depends. So the number one thing I'm looking at is, why are you doing this? Are you doing this because your hip flexors are tight and therefore you can't extend that hip very far back behind you, so you can't kick back? So you need to run with, you know, your legs in front of you. Is that part of this? So then we'll give them an intervention there. Okay, we got to stretch the hip flexors, got to work on glute strength, and then we got to get your form up. So what you're saying about force production is spot on, right? You got to get power back in your form. We don't need you to be doing, you know, four sets of six high intensity lifts or anything, but we need to introduce power into the muscles that are certainly failing. So this is the depends question. Take somebody who's shuffling, you look at their ankles, knees, and hips. That's our sort of our main areas. Okay. Shuffling probably comes more from the hips if they're not taking a long enough stride, or maybe comes from the knees because they're not bending their knees enough. One of the best interventions I can tell somebody who shuffles while running is get your bum in the pool and practice running with good form in there. The ability to generate power is to move force over a certain time frame. So the ability to move your leg up in a certain time, that's power there. So if you're in the water, you're not, number one, you're at more resistance. So you're getting that load to increase. But what you're also doing is providing a safe environment for you to be able to create a high degree of force production without possibly risking the same injuries that you could be at risk for if you were on ground. Get in the pool, practice running, practice high knees, practice jumping jacks, cross-country skiing, things like that that you would not feel comfortable doing on ground because you maybe haven't done those things in years, or that you maybe feel like I don't want to injure myself. I'm just gonna go to a pool. That's why working with a PT can be sometimes sort of beneficial, or working in this case with a running coach. There are running coaches who will work with you exclusively in pools. I mean, there are coaches who will work with you, but the best coach is the one that identifies your, or the best, I should say the best therapist in this case. You go into a PT because you're having pain and you look at your gait pattern and shuffling, identify the deficit and treat the impairment. So you really just want to identify, why am I doing this? And then get with somebody who knows how to fix it, or at least is sensible enough to suggest things that are matched to your deficit. Some people shuffle because they have Parkinson's disease. Some people shuffle because they have tightness. Some people shuffle because they have weakness. And some people shuffle because they don't have the ability to generate enough force to get them up off the ground anymore. But you got to match the impairment and you got to find an intervention that works for that. I love pool running. I think it's really important. I think it's beneficial. And some of my best years running, I spent a lot of time in the pool. And that's not from just an injury prevention standpoint. That's a performance standpoint as well, which I know is really important for a lot of runners.
Do you use a belt when you pool run, or do you just do it without one?
Yeah, I mean, again, it depends. I have a background in swimming. I swam all my life. I find it to be a really challenging workout to do aqua jogging without a belt. So I personally do not use a belt. I do not recommend anybody do that. I think it's probably the best thing you can do. Get yourself a belt. If they have one at the pool already, great. Borrow it. Try it out. See if you like it. The most important intervention is the one you're gonna do. And so if you get to a pool and you don't put a belt on, you aqua jog for 5 minutes and you're like, that was the five hardest minutes of my friggin' life, then that's not the right intervention for you, right? If your goal is to practice LSD pace, the idea of getting in a pool and being fatigued after 5 minutes, that's not gonna get it done. You need to have low intensity. You gotta match what you're trying to do out of water, in the water. If you're trying to produce force, I tell you to get on the ground where you can stand. If you're trying to work on force production, get on the part where you can stand, practice your dynamics, your A skips, your high knees, your butt kicks, your jumping jacks, your skiers. Do it on ground first so you can kind of land safe, do it again, land safe, do it again, so you can produce that. But if you're trying to get for endurance, you know, then you'd graduate. No ground, belt on. Let's do these same things there. I guess there's no real one answer that's better than the other. And if you ask two experts, they could give you really good reasons to do them both. I think start without the belt in the part you can stand on, and then transition to, I can't stand here, I'm going to wear a belt. And then if you're a crazy person like me, then you get it, you get rid of the belt and you just try and survive for the 45 minutes.
I'm just curious, what do you do during your 45 minutes? Do you listen to music with like waterproof headphones, or are you just like masochistic and run in the pool for 45 minutes without a belt and no music?
Julie, I remember when these old waterproof headphones weren't a thing, man. You just get in there and just go for it. What I do, honestly, and this is no joke, I like make lists in my head. Meal prep is a big one, big foodie. So I'm constantly thinking about food. What am I going to do in the next few weeks? Who do I still need to get gifts for the holiday season? What gifts am I going to get them? Nah, I, honest to God, no music, nothing. I just go 45 minutes, mind numbing, right? They always tell us, you know, meditation's good for the mind. It's good for the body. You know, I'm not saying that I'm at relaxed Zen state, but I think there's some truth to a lot of value in just being away from noise and music and social media and all this, and just being at one with yourself, recognizing little things about your body. As a physical therapist, I have a curse and a blessing of, as I'm doing stuff, I can constantly kind of justify what's happening and what's injured or what's feeling in my body. It's not always a good thing, but I do think it's a really important exercise for everybody to have 5 to 10 minutes of just like, let's just take it out and let's just focus. And that to me just so happens to be 14 feet deep pool in the middle of February and a 7 a.m. LA Fitness.
That is crazy. I can't imagine running in a pool with no belt for 45 minutes. Props to you. I would lose my mind. You would just have to pay me, but then I would do it. Props to you. So before we go, I just had a couple more questions. The first is, I know that I was one of your anomalous patients. I don't mean to make myself sound special, but you told me that a few times. Like, generally, you do not treat 50-year-old ACL patients. So what, if anything, did you learn from working with me this year? And what, if anything, would you have done differently? And what, if anything, should I have done differently? Don't be shy. I want to hear your feedback.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's time to unpack Julie for a second. All right. So that's a good question. You are an anomalous ACL patient. Chances are PTs that have been working 10, 15, 20 years haven't treated an ACL patient above the age of 50 because they're not participating in things that usually tear their ACLs. You, even though you are above the age of 50, biologically and chronologically, there's a total difference there. Chronologically, sure, whatever. Yeah, you're about north 50, but you're still young, and therefore, and your body is still so fit and active, and therefore, you probably think you ought to do more things than you should. I think that definitely played into it. You were more of a mental than a physical battle at times, not from the standpoint of being like, hey, calm down. No, nothing like that. It was more about, hey, let's unpack this. What are we needing to do differently? Because you've done so well up to this point, but we're reaching a point. Not every ACL patient wants to run 8, 10, 12, 15, 20 miles. In fact, I don't think I've ever treated an ACL patient that wanted to run more than a couple miles at a time, because the majority of these folks are tennis, soccer, basketball, and football players. So with you, one of the challenges was creating interventions, or tailoring interventions rather, to your specific needs. So I'll give you an example of that. You and I, we did a little bit of plyometrics at points in time where I look back and I think, why was I doing that? What was our goal? Every PT should approach every treatment session with every patient saying, what is our end goal, and how am I going to accomplish, or how am I going to move towards that in our session today? And I think for you, when I look back, I think, should we have done more low load, high duration stuff early on? Should we have done more mini wall sits for minutes on end to practice the muscular endurance of for your muscles, as opposed to the power aspect? You don't need a high degree of power, muscular power, which is like the true definition of power, to be able to run distance running. In fact, it's pretty opposite. Power is defined over short periods of time. Distance running is quite the opposite. So maybe I would have tailored your intervention slightly more towards muscular endurance in all aspects. Now, that being said, again, I'm going to pretty much defend anything I did with you. I think we did a fair amount of that. And I think that you did so well on all that stuff. A lot of times you were such a good patient. It was like, I have to come up with the thing that she's not doing. I have to be the new or the unique, because, you know, she's doing so many things at home because she's such a good patient. I need to provide something for her to feel like her time and her effort and her money is worth being here. And that's a dangerous thing, especially as a new therapist, feeling like you have to change the world in every session. And I think I got caught up in that a little bit at times, especially when we were, you know, 4 months out. The ACL graft is revascularized after a period of devascularization, and we get the training wheels off, ready to rock and roll. We're doing, you know, decline squats. We're doing, you know, jump squats. We're doing descending squats. We're doing all sorts of fun, you know, kind of high level stuff. But it's the match the intervention to the individual kind of thing that we're talking about. Did we need to be doing a lot of the stuff? Do we need to be cutting in the parking lot? It's good that you can do it. We need to make sure you can do it, because what if you want to play tennis with your friends on a vacation or pick it up as a sport? I need to make sure you can hold up doing it. But could we have done other things? You know, that's probably what I think. One of the other things I'll say briefly is that sometimes the hardest patients to treat are the ones that know so much. Because you are maybe not feeling like, you know, it's different with you, but like sometimes I feel like I'm almost like at odds with the person trying to say like, no, you need this. And they're like, well, I do plenty of that at home. I'm like, well, actually. So that was definitely some component of it. You for the most part, you would agree, probably didn't do nearly as much weights and high intensity stuff that you do now compared to before the ACL. But again, as a PT, you got to be able to justify every intervention. And my justification is you need your quad to be at a high enough strength that it can match the other quad. You need your hamstring to be at least 80% of what your quad strength is on the surgical side for us to say confidently, all right, yeah, you're ready to go. And one of the ways that we increase strength is we increase the load. And so, you know, it's more about matching the intervention to the individual. I think we did a good job. Did we do a perfect job? No, I think in all aspects, we probably could have done certain things a little better here, a little better there. But I look back on your care, and I'd put your case up with any of the ones I've treated. Say, you know what, we did a good job here.
I totally agree. I think you did an amazing job, and I mean the fact that also you were dealing with a patient who also asked a lot of questions, and I always appreciated that we worked together as a team. I never felt like you were directing me what to do at all. It was more like together we would figure out what worked. And I appreciated that, because I think that the best healthcare providers are those who know what they don't know, because you work in the field of science. And I love that you're always questioning and learning, and that's what makes you an excellent provider. And that's what you want out of a provider is someone who says, I know my craft, but I am always learning and questioning and evolving with the science. So I really appreciate all you did for me. And of course, Lisa and I appreciate that you took the time this evening after a long day to share more about physical therapy and your background for our listeners. And it was just such a treat to talk with you, Josh, tonight. And thank you so much for joining us. Before we go, I just want to ask you if there's any advice you have for runners out there who are teeing up for their Boston Marathon training cycle. What advice do you have for them as we record this in mid-December?
It's a big race, right? And for a lot of the folks who are doing it, sometimes it's their first, sometimes it's their fifth, but it's a big race and it's one of the biggest of the year. Every day is important. Every day is not the most important day. The thing that I would tell you is that in a training phase, there are days where you are supposed to run hard and there are days where you are not. If you have a good plan and a good coach, run hard when you run hard and run easy when you run easy. It's the same concept as the best runners in the world. Train hard and rest hard. If you have an easy run that day, you run the heck out of that easy run. Doesn't mean you run fast, but you get to that run, you say, I should have run easy and I did. My heart rate should have stayed at this level and it did. There is a reason you run fast and there is a reason you run slow. You got a good plan. You got an even better coach. You're going to be just fine, but you got to take it seriously. And that doesn't mean run every run far. That doesn't run every run fast. Okay. Your rest days are when you get faster. Your rest days are when you get stronger. If you don't allow enough rest, that doesn't just mean days, it just means in any aspect of your life, you don't allow enough rest, you're not going to get better, faster, stronger. So my advice, as the generic PT advice, as you would expect, is you got to listen to your body. But if you train hard, you sure as heck better, you better rest hard too, because then you're not doing yourself a good service there.
Great advice. Thank you so much, Josh. I know you're not on social media, but if folks want to find you or contact you, how can they do that?
Well, definitely find me on Facebook. I definitely use Facebook. And if you have any problems related to orthopedics, physical therapy, running, anything of the sort, give ProAction Physical Therapy a call. I'm sure you plug it most times you're on this, but we're located in the North Bethesda region. We treat one-on-one. It's a very unique part of our practice, and it makes it so our quality of care is at an utmost highest level. You do not get an aide. You don't get anyone else. You get me, and you get 45 minutes, and we're going to rock and roll this whole time. So come find us at ProAction Physical Therapy. Give us a call. Look it up on our website. But if you don't find me on Facebook, you can find me there.
All right. Well, Josh, thank you so much, and we really appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks, Julie. It was a blast.
Thank you so much for listening to the Run Farther and Faster Boston Marathon podcast. We want to give a special thanks to our editor, Aaron Bryant. And if you enjoyed this episode and enjoy listening to our podcast, please share it with others. And please leave a review if you haven't done so already on iTunes. Thanks for listening and have a great week.